Good morning. On today's programme, corruption and Chinese investment in Kenya and the old marble mines of southern Portugal. But first we go to New York, where this week the United Nations will host its annual meeting of heads of state for the opening of the next General Assembly session. The week of meetings and events known as UNGA will feature discussions on everything from the war in Ukraine to pandemic prevention. But the UN leadership wants its plan for sustainable development goals known as SDGs to be given priority. However, it can be a hard topic to wrap your mind around, as Yvonne Murray reports from New York.
The barricades are going up on First Avenue outside the United Nations headquarters. NYPD helicopters are circling, and New Yorkers are already beginning to complain about gridlock. It can only mean one thing. World leaders are about to descend on the city for UNGA, the annual UN General Assembly Week. This will be its 78th session. It's a dizzying schedule of high-level meetings and less high-level side events that even the most seasoned of UN watchers find hard to keep up with. But this year, there are three main items on the agenda. First, on Monday, the Summit on Sustainable Development Goals will open. If you find yourself glazing over at the mention of Sustainable Development Goals, you aren't alone. I'll get back to this in a minute. On Tuesday, it's the official opening of the General Assembly when heads of state make their remarks. Because of some historical quirk of UN procedure, Brazil always gets the first slot, followed by the US president as host country. But the star turn this year is likely to be Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine, who will address the assembly in person for the first time since Russia invaded Ukraine. On Wednesday, a climate ambition summit starts. This is the baby of the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, whose warnings about climate breakdown are increasingly apocalyptic. But he told the press this week that it's really sustainable development goals that need to take centre stage. Why? Because they're way off track and risk, in his words, becoming an epitaph for a world that might have been. So what are these sustainable development goals, and why does the UN think they are so important? I took off to the lobby of UNHQ to ask people who work here about them. Many were unsure of how many there were. Were there 18, perhaps 30? But with some prompting, most could remember that there were 17. Asked when they were due to be reached, there was some confusion over whether it was 2050 or 2030. The correct answer is 2030. But by far the hardest question was, how many can you name? Most people could recall the headline grabbers like no hunger, zero poverty, gender equality, clean water. But the trickier ones were those that don't trip off the tongue to the same extent, like decent work and economic growth, sustainable cities and communities, responsible consumption and production, or affordable and clean energy. I asked one of the authors of a new UN report appraising the progress or lack of progress whether it was a problem for the goals that even people working at the UN struggled to name them. She suggested that I was asking the wrong question. Ask what people need for a better life, she said, and you might get closer to the right answer. I'll try that next time. Over the past few months, Ireland, along with Qatar, has worked as what they call here co-facilitators for the goals. It involved knocking heads together to build consensus and basically get everyone to commit to getting the agenda back on track. It was no easy task with the current fault lines inside the UN, like those between the heavyweight countries like Russia and the US, as well as the divisions between the rich and poorer states being exposed. Nevertheless, the UN and particularly the Secretary General are determined that it will be full steam ahead this week to try and breathe life into the 2030 agenda. The pandemic, the cost of living crisis, as well as the highest level of armed conflict since 1945, have sent many of the goals into reverse. But a huge colour-coded tent in the grounds of UNHQ dedicated to the goals is guaranteed to grab the attention of world leaders as they arrive here this week. But holding their attention with so many other things on the agenda might be a challenge. For World Report, I'm Yvonne Murray at the UN in New York.
Next, we go to Kenya, a country which has seen the expansion of infrastructure investment by Chinese companies. But as Hannah McCarthy has been finding out in Nairobi, not all infrastructure projects are designed with the best interests of ordinary Kenyans in mind.
The plane soars over the sprawling metropolis of Nairobi before landing at Jomo Kenyatta Airport, the main international airport in Kenya. The airport was originally known as Embakasi Airport and was built in the 1950s by thousands of Kikuyu prisoners interned by the British colonial government that ruled Kenya then. Hundreds of these men and boys died while building the airport in Nairobi. Most had been rounded up and imprisoned without trial as part of a brutal response to the Mau Mau Rebellion. During the rebellion, thousands of Kikuyu men and women protested over their dire living conditions and waged a guerrilla war against the colonial government that had taken their farmland and granted it to mostly white settlers from Britain. When the British-backed government eventually withdrew from Kenya in 1963, it left widespread devastation, particularly among the Kikuyu people, who had suffered mass imprisonment, torture, and the desecration of their way of life. The colonial administration also left behind a deeply dysfunctional system of government in Kenya. The Kenyan government has been corrupt from day one. It inherited a colonial system that was designed to extract resources from the poor up to a tiny minority, says Owen Flynn, an Irish businessman based in Nairobi for the last 11 years. Kenya would grow and develop 10 times more if corruption disappeared, he says. In 2020, Owen opened up a craft brewery called 254 Brewing in the satellite town of Kikuyu outside of Nairobi. It's where many of the Kikuyu people moved to after being forcibly removed from their land by the colonial administration. Owen says he loves Kenya and the Kenyan people, but can't deny that today it's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. He described how recently armed guards arrived unannounced at his brewery in Kikuyu. With guns, they forced his employees to leave before locking up all the doors and telling them they weren't getting back in because the brewery's pipes had the wrong colour. Owen says it took him 2 weeks to regain access to his brewery. Last year, Owen opened up a bar in downtown Nairobi to sell the craft beer being made in Kikuyu. In front of the bar runs the new express highway to Jomo Kenyatta Airport, which the Chinese government helped to build high above the normal road. The expressway opened last year and costs around €3, an amount few in the city can afford to pay regularly. When I visit Owen's bar in downtown Nairobi, rush hour is starting. Buses and cars are crawling along the normal road, while motorbikes try to weave in and out of the slow-moving traffic. High above the crowded road, a few cars speed easily along the express highway, bringing the few drivers with enough money to pay the toll quickly to their destination. Owen remarks that the express highway to the airport wasn't designed to alleviate congestion. It was a way for richer people to simply avoid it. We built the most elitist infrastructure project on the continent, he says. For example, in Ethiopia, the government asked China to help build a light railway system in the capital, Addis Ababa, that everybody can use, says Owen. Owen lived in China for 3 years and has followed Chinese engagement with Africa. In his view, China acts in its self-interest when it comes to these public projects in Africa. China is very blunt in the way that it does business, but it's relatively straightforward as well. It does business with governments in every country in Africa. If the government that China does business with acts and makes decisions with their people's interests at heart, the Chinese engagement will work out well for the people of that country, says Owen. But if the government makes deals with China for the self-interest of a small number of individuals, then it's not going to work out well for the people. As Nairobi's population soars to nearly 4.5 million people, the city's residents badly need better public infrastructure. But few are holding out hope of the Kenyan government delivering. Selfishly, as an individual, I love the expressway, says Owen. But as a use of public funds for the people of Kenya, it doesn't get much worse. For World Report, I'm Hannah McCarthy in Nairobi.
Finally, we go to Portugal and to the Alentejo region, which has had a rich history of marble mining. Now discarded marble from the old mines forms spectacular piles of waste, and they stand as monuments to the harsh conditions endured by the people who worked there. From Portugal, Connor Power reports.
As you approach the beautiful fortified hill town of Estremoz in southern Portugal, on the main road from the east and the Spanish border, the first sight that you notice from a far distance is an enormous structure on your left-hand side. You might easily assume that it is the city itself, But as you draw closer, you see that there's something strange about it, and you realise that it is a precariously assembled gigantic pile of waste marble blocks from an abandoned marble mine. It's just one of many structures in this area. The Eshtemoz Anticline is a marble vein that measures 27 square kilometres and which runs alongside the towns of Eshtemoz, Borba and Vila Viçosa in the southern Alentejo region of Portugal. Marble mining began in this part of the world in Roman times, but it wasn't until about a century ago that marble mining on an industrial scale began. And it wasn't until the period from the 1960s to the 1980s that marble production was really ramped up, after new technologies such as diamond wire was introduced, and after clients in Saudi Arabia began to discover the beauty of white Portuguese marble. Marble production here reached its peak in the 1980s, with most of the stone being exported to the Middle East. The Gulf War of the early 1990s marked the beginning of the decline of the business, and today, while marble mining still goes on, it's at about 10% of the turnover of the peak time. The gold rush that marble mining created here was easy to understand when you consider that this was the poorest region in all of Europe, with high unemployment and a strong tradition of emigration. Those that worked in the mines in those boom times have bittersweet memories. "I don't know anyone who likes working in a marble mine," says Joaquim Malta, recently retired, but who spent 40 years in the mines, having begun 45 years ago when he was just 15. He followed in the footsteps of his father and of his grandfather, working day in, day out, in often brutal conditions. "In the hot days," he says, "you could be working in temperatures of up to 50 degrees, while in the rainy days, you work in water up to your ankles, sometimes up to your knees." Another recently retired worker is Ignacio José. He also began his marble mining career aged 15. He too followed in his father's footsteps after his father died under a mining collapse when Ignacio was just 5 years old. He also speaks of the harsh treatment he has known for much of his mining life. "When we get sick," he says, "when we protest about anything, they make us do the hardest jobs and delay payments of wages. The worst of it, though, was looking up at the top of the crater and feeling that fear every day, that anguish of not knowing when our turn would come." On the afternoon of the 18th of November in 2018, after weeks of heavy rain, such a day did come for six people who died when a public road running between two deep quarries collapsed, dragging three vehicles with it. Most of the marble mined in this area has veins of russet sediment running through it. When it's dry, it's as hard as concrete, but when it's wet, it can be like butter. Two of the victims are still buried in the now abandoned marble mine. Joaquim was one of the survivors. Of the 271 cavities along the Eshtemoz Anticline, about 60 are still operating. Where there was agriculture land many decades ago, there's now a series of deep holes and large piles of marble waste. "There are so many, and they're so concentrated, that it's rare to go more than 100 metres deep," says Ruben Martins, a geological engineer from the University of Évora. With everyone starting to dig a hole in their own patch of land, rather than working together and creating a much wider quarry, the deepest one is 150 metres, whereas geological studies show that there is still marble at 430 metres deep. Less haste and less greed might have created a safer, more sustainable and more profitable marble industry. Marble mines around the gorgeous marble-clad towns of Eshtemoz, Vila Viçosa and Borba continue to operate, and they are embedded in the area's economy and social history. As for those stunning quasi-brutalist mountains of waste on the landscape, their future remains uncertain. Some of the piles have already been put to good use as base material for building the A6 motorway that now runs east-west through the region. The latest initiative, though, is with the Science Museum in Eshtemoz, who are now conducting tours of some of the mines and of their magnificent piles of real-life Minecraft. For RTE World Report in Eshtemoz, southern Portugal, this is Connor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.